Chapter 33, Tuesday, November 11th. By the next day, Brent is back on Unicorn, and one of the Level 3 engineers has joined Dick's team somewhere in the snowy Midwest. Within hours, I get copied on an email from Sarah. From Sarah Moulton to Bob Strauss. CC, Dick Landry, Steve Masters, Bill Palmer. Date, November 11th, 7:24 a.m. Subject, someone is undermining Project Talon.
Bob, I've discovered that Bill Palmer, the acting VP of IT operations, stole the critical resource for Project Talon. Bill, I'm deeply concerned with your recent actions. Please explain to us why you ordered Brent to return home. This is absolutely intolerable. The board has instructed us to explore strategic options. I demand that Brent rejoin the Talon team as soon as possible. Please confirm you understand this message. Sarah.
Genuinely alarmed that I'm being called out on an email to the company chairman, I call Steve, who is obviously furious at Sarah's apparent change in loyalties. After swearing under his breath, he assures me that he'll handle this and that I am to continue as planned. At the daily Unicorn stand-up meeting, William doesn't look happy.
The good news is that as of last night, we've generated our first customer promotion report, and it appears to be working correctly. But the code is running 50 times slower than we expected. One of the clustering algorithms isn't parallelizing like we thought it would, so the prediction runs are already taking more than 24 hours, even for our small customer data set.
Grumbles and groans go around the room. One of the developers says, "Can't we just use brute force? Just throw more hardware at the problem? With enough compute servers, we can bring the runtimes down."
"Are you kidding me?" Wes says with exasperation. "We only budgeted for 20 of the fastest servers we could find. You'd need over 1,000 servers to get the runtimes down to where we need. That's over $1 million in unbudgeted capital."
I purse my lips. Wes is right. Phoenix is way over budget as it is, and we're talking about a large enough amount of money that it'll be impossible to get this approved, especially given our financial condition.
"We don't need any new hardware," the developer replies. "We've invested all this effort to create compute images that we can deploy. Why not send them out to the cloud? We could spin up hundreds or thousands of compute instances as we need them, tear them down when we're done, and just pay for the compute time we use."
Wes looks at Brent, who says,
"It's possible. We're already using virtualization for most of our environments. It shouldn't be very difficult to convert them so that they run on a cloud computing provider."
After a moment, he adds,
"You know, that would be fun. I've always wanted to try something like this."
Brent's excitement is contagious. We start assigning tasks to investigate its feasibility. Brent teams up with the developer who had suggested the idea to do a quick prototype to see whether it is even possible. Maggie, who has taken such an interest in Unicorn that she's routinely attending the daily stand-ups, volunteers to look into pricing and will call her peers in the industry to see if any of them have done this before and to get any recommended vendors. One of John's security engineers interrupts.
"Sending our customer data to the cloud may have some risks, like accidental disclosure of private data or someone unauthorized hacking into those compute servers."
"Good thinking," I say. "Can you list your top risks we should be thinking about and prepare a list of potential countermeasures and controls?" He smiles in response, happy to be asked. One of the developers volunteers to work with him. By the end of the meeting, I'm surprised at the unanticipated payoffs of automating our deployment process. The developers can more quickly scale the application, and potentially few changes would be required from us. Despite this, I'm extremely dubious of all this cloud computing hullabaloo. People treat it as if it's some sort of magical elixir that instantaneously reduces costs. In my mind, it's just another form of outsourcing. But if it solves a problem we're having, I'm willing to give it a try. I remind Wes to keep an open mind as well. A week later, once again, it's demo time.
We're all standing in the Unicorn team area. It's the end of the sprint, and the development lead is eager to show off what the team has accomplished.
I can hardly believe how much we got done, he starts off. Because of all the deployment automation, getting compute instances running in the cloud wasn't as hard as we thought. In fact, it's working so well that we're considering turning all the in-house Unicorn production systems into test systems and using the cloud for all our production systems. We start the recommendations reporting run every evening and spin up hundreds of compute instances until we're done, and then we turn them off. We've been doing this for the past 4 days, and it's working well. Really well.
Brent has a wide smile on his face, as does the rest of the team. Next up is usually the product manager, but this time Maggie is presenting instead. She's obviously taking more than just casual interest in this project. She pulls up a PowerPoint slide on the projector.
These are the Unicorn promotions generated for my customer account. As you can see, it's looked at my buying history and is letting me know that snow tires and batteries are 15% off. I actually went to our website and purchased both because I need them. The company just made money because those are all items that we have excess inventory and high profit margins.
I smile. Now that's brilliant.
And here are the Unicorn promotions for Wes, she continues, going to the next slide with a smile. Looks like you got a discount on racing brake pads and fuel additives. That of any interest to you?
Wes smiles.
Not bad.
Maggie explains that all these offers are already in the Phoenix system, and it was just waiting for the promotion functionality to finally get them to the customers. She continues.
Here's my proposal. I'd like to do an email campaign to 1% of our customers to see what happens. Thanksgiving is in 1 week. If we could do a couple of trials and everything goes well, we'd go full blast on Black Friday, which is the busiest shopping day of the year.
Sounds like a good plan, I say. Wes, is there any reason why we shouldn't do this? Wes shakes his head.
From an ops perspective, I can't think of any. All the hard work has already been done. If Chris, William, and marketing have confidence that the code is working, I say go for it.
Everyone agrees. There are some issues that come up, but Maggie says her team is willing to work all night to make it happen. I smile inwardly. For once, it won't be just us staying up all night because something went really wrong. In fact, it's the exact opposite. People are staying up all night because everything was going right. The following Monday, it's barely above freezing as I'm driving to work, but the sun is shining brightly. It looks like it's going to be a great week for the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday. Throughout the weekend, I'm a bit startled to see commercials with Santa Claus in them. When I get to my office, I throw my heavy coat over my chair. I turn when I hear Patty walk into my office and see that she has a broad smile on her face.
Did you hear the amazing news from marketing?
When I shake my head, she merely says,
read the email that Maggie just sent out.
I flip open my laptop and read. From Maggie Lee. To Chris Allers, Bill Palmer, CC, Steve Masters, Wes Davis, Sarah Moulton. Date, November 24th, 7:47 a.m. Subject, First Unicorn Promotion Campaign. Unbelievable.
The marketing team burned the midnight oil over the weekend, and we were able to do a test campaign to 1% of our customers. The results were stellar. Over 20% of the respondents went to our website, and over 6% purchased. These are incredibly high conversion rates, probably over 5 times higher than any campaign we've done before. We recommend doing a Unicorn promotion to all our customers on Thanksgiving Day. I'm working to get a dashboard up so everyone can see real-time results of the Unicorn campaigns. Also, remember that all the items being promoted are high-margin items, so the effects on our bottom line will be excellent. P.S. Bill, based on the results, we expect a huge surge in web traffic. Can we make sure the website won't fall over? Great work, all. Maggie.
I love it, I say to Patty. Work with Wes to figure out what we need to do to handle the surge in traffic. We've only got 3 days to get this done, so we don't have much time. We don't want to screw this up and turn prospective customers into haters. She nods and is about to respond when her phone vibrates. An instant later, my phone vibrates too. She quickly looks down and says, "The Dragon Lady strikes again." "I wish I had an unsubscribe button for her emails," Patty says as she walks out. A half hour later, Steve sent out a congratulatory note to the entire Unicorn team, which everyone loved reading. More surprisingly, he also sent out a very public reply to Sarah, demanding that she stop stirring the pot and making trouble, and to see me at your earliest convenience. That still didn't stop all the public emails going back and forth among Sarah, Steve, and Bob. Seeing Sarah toadying up to our new chairman, Bob, was awkward and uncomfortable. It's like Sarah didn't even care how obvious she was being, and all the bridges she was burning. I walk into a meeting room to meet John about the resolution of all the SOX 404 and Unicorn security issues. He's wearing a pinstriped Oxford shirt and a vest, complete with cufflinks. He looks like he just came out of a Vanity Fair photo shoot, and I guess he's continuing to shave his head daily. "I'm amazed how quickly the Unicorn security fixes are being integrated," he says. "Compared to the rest of Phoenix, fixing Unicorn security issues is a breeze. The cycle time is so short, we once put in a fix within an hour. More typically, we can get fixes in within a day or two. Compared to this, remediating Phoenix issues is like pulling our own teeth out, without any anesthesia. Normally, we'd have to wait for a quarter for any meaningful changes to be made, and jumping through all the hoops required to get an emergency change order through was almost not worth the trouble." "Really," he continues, "patching is so easy because we can rebuild anything in production with a touch of a button. If it breaks, we can build it again from scratch." I nod. I'm amazed at what we can do with the fast Unicorn cycle times, too. With Phoenix, we only rehearsed and practiced doing the deployments once per quarter. Just in the last 5 weeks, we've done over 20 Unicorn code and environment deployments. It almost feels routine. As you said, it's the opposite of Phoenix. John says, "Most of the reservations I had about Unicorn don't seem valid anymore. We've put in regular checks to make sure that the developers who have daily access to production only have read-only access, and we're making good progress on integrating our security tests into the build procedures. I'm pretty confident that any changes that could affect data security or the authentication modules will get caught quickly." He leans back, crossing his arms behind his head. "I was scared shitless of how we'd gain any sort of assurance about securing Unicorn. It's partly because we're so used to taking a month to turn around application security review. In an emergency, like in response to a high-priority audit, we could sometimes turn things around in a week. But the notion of having to keep up with 10 deploys a day," he continues, "complete lunacy. But after being forced to automate our security testing and integrating it into the same process that William uses for his automated QA testing, we're testing every time a developer commits code. In many ways, we now have better visibility and code coverage than any of the other applications in the company." He adds, "You should know that we just closed out the last of the SOX 404 issues. We were able to prove to the auditors, thanks in large part to the new change control processes you put in, that all the current controls are sufficient, closing out the 3-year repeat audit finding." With a smile, he adds, "Congratulations, Bill. You've done what none of your predecessors have been able to do, which is to finally get the auditors off our back." Much to my surprise, the short week goes smoothly. Before everyone leaves on Wednesday for the Thanksgiving holiday, the big Unicorn campaign is ready. Code performance is still 10 times slower than we need, but we're okay for now, because we can just spin up hundreds of compute instances in the cloud. We had a genuine showstopper when QA discovered that we were recommending items that were out of stock. That would have been disastrous, as customers would excitedly click on the promotion, only to find them listed as back-ordered. Incredibly, development developed a fix within a day, and it was deployed within an hour. It's 6 p.m., and I pack up my stuff, looking forward to the long weekend. We've all earned it. Chapter 34. Friday, November 28th. By midday Thursday, right in the middle of Thanksgiving, we knew we were in trouble. The overnight unicorn email promotion was an incredible success. The response rate was unprecedentedly high, with traffic to our website surging to record levels, which kept bringing down our e-commerce systems. We initiated an emergency SEV1 call, putting in all sorts of emergency measures to maintain our ability to take orders, including putting more servers into rotation and turning off computationally intensive features. Ironically, one of the developers suggested turning off all the real-time recommendations which we had worked so hard to build. Why recommend more products to buy, he argued, if customers can't even complete a transaction? Maggie quickly agreed, but it still took the developers 2 hours to change and deploy. Now, this feature can be disabled with a configuration setting, so we can do it in minutes next time around, instead of requiring a full code rollout. Now that's what I call designing for IT operations. It's getting easier and easier to manage the code in production. We also kept optimizing database queries and moving the largest site graphics to a third-party content distribution network, offloading more traffic from our servers. By late Thanksgiving afternoon, the customer experience had improved to something tolerable. The real trouble began the following morning. Although it is an official company holiday, I've called every one of my staff back into the office. Wes, Patty, Brent, and Maggie are here for the noon meeting. Chris is here, but has apparently decided that being called in today demanded a different dress code. He's wearing a garish Hawaiian shirt and jeans and has brought in coffee and donuts for everyone. Maggie convened the meeting a couple of minutes ago. This morning, our store managers opened up their locations for Black Friday. From the moment they opened the doors, people poured in, waving around printouts of their unicorn promotion emails. In-store traffic today is at record levels. The problem is that the promoted items are now almost completely gone. Our store managers started panicking because customers were leaving angry and empty-handed. When store managers try to issue rain checks or get an item shipped to the customer, they're having to manually key in the order from our warehouse. It's taking them at least 15 minutes per order, which is resulting in long lines at the stores and more frustrated customers. Just then, the speakerphone on the table beeps. Sarah dialing in. Who's on the line? Maggie rolls her eyes, and several other people mutter to one another. Sarah's attempts to undermine Unicorn are well known now. Maggie has to take 2 minutes to announce everyone on the call and catch her up. Thank you, Sarah says. I'll remain on the call. Please continue. Maggie thanks her politely and begins brainstorming on how to solve the problems. An hour later, we generated 20 actions we'll be tackling all weekend long. We'll be putting up a web page for store personnel where they can type in the coupon promotion code, which will automate the cross-shipment from our warehouses. In addition, we'll create a new form on the customer account web page where they can get items delivered directly to them. It's a long list. By Monday morning, the situation has stabilized, which is good because we have our weekly unicorn meeting with Steve. Chris, Wes, Patty, and John are here. Unlike our previous meetings, Sarah is here too. She sits with her arms crossed, occasionally uncrossing them to tap out messages to someone on her iPhone. Steve says to all of us with a wide smile, I want to congratulate you for all your hard work. It has paid off beyond my wildest expectations. Thanks to Unicorn, both in-store and web sales are breaking records, resulting in record weekly revenue. At the current run rate, marketing estimates that we'll hit profitability this quarter. It will be our first profitable quarter since the middle of last year.
My heartiest congratulations to you all, he says. Everyone, except Sarah, smiles at the news.
That's only half the story, Steve, Chris says. The Unicorn team is kicking butt. They've moved from doing deployments every 2 weeks to every week, and we're now experimenting with doing daily deployments. Because the batch size is so much smaller, we can make small changes very quickly. We're now doing A-B testing all the time. In short, we've never been able to respond to the market this quickly, and I'm sure there are more rabbits we can pull out of this hat. I nod emphatically. I suppose we'll want to follow the Unicorn model for any new applications we develop internally. It's easier to scale, as well as easier to manage, than any application we've supported in the past. We're setting up the processes and procedures so that we can deploy at whatever rate it takes to quickly respond to customers. In some cases, we're even enabling developers to deploy the code. The developer will be able to push a button, and within several minutes, the code will be in the testing environment or in production. I can't believe how far we've come in such a short time. I'm proud of all of you, Steve says. I want to commend you for truly working together and being worthy of one another's trust.
Better late than never, I suppose, Sarah says. If we're done congratulating ourselves, I've got a business wake-up call for you. Earlier this month, our largest retail competitor started partnering with their manufacturers to allow custom build-to-order kits. Sales of some of our top-selling items are already down 20% since they launched this offering. Angrily, she adds, "For years, I've been trying to get IT to build out the infrastructure to enable this capacity, but all we heard was, 'No, it can't be done.' Meanwhile, our competition has been able to work with any manufacturer who says yes." She adds, "That's why Bob's idea of splitting up the company has so much merit. We're being shackled by the legacy manufacturing side of this business."
What? Buying the retail firm was her idea. Maybe life would have been easier for everyone if she had just gone to work for a retailer. Steve frowns. This is the next agenda item. As Senior Vice President of Retail Operations, it's Sarah's prerogative to bring business needs and risks to this team. Wes snorts. To Sarah, he says,
"You're kidding, right? Do you understand what we just achieved with Unicorn and how fast we did it? What you're describing isn't that difficult compared to what we just pulled off."
The next day, Wes walks in wearing an uncharacteristically glum face.
Boss, I hate to say it, but I don't think it can be done.
When I ask him to explain, he says,
"To do what our competitor is doing, we'd have to completely rewrite our manufacturing resource planning system that supports all the plants. It's an old mainframe application that we've used for decades. We outsourced it 3 years ago, mostly because old people like you were going to retire soon. No offense," he adds. "We laid off many of our mainframe people years ago. They were making salaries way above the norm. Some outsourcer convinced our CIO at the time that they had the gray-haired workforce that could keep our application on life support until we retired it. Our plan was that we would replace the newer ERP system, but obviously we never got around to it."
"Damn it. We're the customer and they're our supplier," I say. "Tell them that we're paying them not to just maintain the application, but also to make any needed business changes. According to Sarah, we need this change. So find out how much they want to charge us and how long we'll have to wait."
"I did that," Wes says, pulling out a ream of paper from under his arm. "Here's the proposal they finally sent after I managed to get the stupid account manager out of the way so I could actually talk to one of the technical analysts. They want 6 months to gather the requirements, another 9 months to develop and test, and if we're lucky, we might be able to put it into production 1 year from now," he continues. "The problem is, the resources we need aren't available until June. So,
We're talking about 18 months, minimum. To even start the process, they would need $50,000 for a feasibility study and to secure a slot in their development schedule.
Wes is bright red now, shaking his head.
That worthless account manager keeps insisting that the contract just won't allow him to help us. Bastard. Obviously, his job is to make sure that everything that can be billed for is, and to dissuade us from doing anything not on the contract, like development.
I exhale loudly, thinking through the implications. The constraint preventing us from going where we need to go is now outside our organization. But if it's outside the organization, what can we possibly do? We can't convince an outsourcer to change their priorities or their management practices as we've done. Suddenly, a glimmer of an idea hits me. How many people do they have allocated to our account? I ask.
I don't know, Wes says. I think there are 6 people assigned at 30% allocation. It probably depends on their role.
Get Patty in here, along with a copy of the contract, and let's work through the math. And see if you can grab someone from purchasing, too. I have an audacious proposal that I'd like to explore.
Who outsourced the MRP application? Steve asks from behind his desk. I'm sitting in Steve's office with Chris, Wes, and Patty, with Sarah standing off to the side, whom I try to ignore. I explain our idea to Steve again. Many years ago, we decided that this application wasn't a critical part of the business, so we outsourced it to cut costs. Obviously, they didn't view it as a core competency.
Well, it's obviously a core competency now, replies Steve. Right now, that outsourcer is holding us hostage, preventing us from doing something that needs to be done. They're more than just a roadblock. They're now jeopardizing our future.
I nod.
In short, we'd like to break the outsourcing contract early, bringing those resources back into the company. We're talking about approximately 6 people, some of whom are still on site. To buy out the remainder of the contract 2 years early would be almost $1 million, and we would regain complete control of the MRP application and underlying infrastructure. Everyone on this team believes this is the right thing to do, and we've even got the initial blessing from Dick's team.
I hold my breath. I just threw out a very big number. It's considerably bigger than the budget increase I asked for 2 months ago when I got thrown out of the office. I quickly continue.
Chris believes that once this MRP application is back in-house, we could build an interface to Unicorn. We would then start building the manufacturing capability to move us from build to inventory to build to order, which would enable us to provide the custom kits as Sarah requested. If we execute everything flawlessly and the integration with the order entry and inventory management systems goes as planned, we could match what our competitors are doing in about 90 days.
Out of the corner of my eye, I can see the wheels turning furiously in Sarah's head. Steve doesn't shoot down the idea right away.
Okay, you have my attention. What are the top risks?
Chris takes this one.
The outsourcer may have made big changes to the code base that we don't know about, which would slow down the development schedule. But my personal belief is that this risk is minimal. Based on their behavior, I don't think they made any significant changes to functionality. I'm not worried about the technical challenges, he continues. The MRP was not designed for large batch sizes, and certainly not batch sizes of one that we're talking about here. But I'm sure we can make something work short-term and figure out a long-term strategy as we go.
When Chris finishes, Patty adds,
The outsourcer could also decide to make the transition back to us difficult, and there could be animosity from the affected engineers. There were a lot of hard feelings when we announced the contract. Among other things, their pay was cut the instant they switched from being Parts Unlimited employees to being a vendor. She continues, We should get John involved right away,
because we'll need to take away access from all the outsourcer staff that we're not bringing back in.
Wes laughs, saying,
I'd like to personally delete the login credentials of that jackass account manager. He's a jerk.
Steve is listening attentively. He then turns to Sarah and asks, Your thoughts on the team's proposal? She says nothing for several moments, but eventually says imperiously,
I think we need to check with Bob Strauss and get full board approval before we undertake a project this big and risky. Given the previous performance of IT, this could jeopardize all of our manufacturing operations, which is more risk than I think we should take on. In short, I personally do not support this proposal.
Steve studies Sarah, saying with a thin-lipped smile, Remember that you work for me, not Bob. If you can't work within that arrangement, I will need your immediate resignation. Sarah turns white, her jaw dropping, obviously realizing she's badly misplayed her hand. Struggling to regain her composure, she laughs nervously at Steve's comment, but no one else joins in. I furtively look at my colleagues and see that, like me, their eyes are wide, watching this drama unfold. Steve continues, On the contrary, thanks to IT, we may no longer need to consider all the onerous strategic options that you and Bob are preparing. But your point is well taken. To the rest of us, Steve says, I'm assigning you one of Dick's best people and our corporate counsel. They'll help you flawlessly execute this project and make sure we use every trick in the book to get what we need from the outsourcer. I'll make sure Dick gives this project his personal attention.
Sarah's eyes widen even further. That's an excellent idea, Steve. That would significantly reduce our risk here. I think Bob will really like it.
The expression on Steve's face suggests that his patience for her theatrics is nearly at an end. He asks us if there's anything else we need. When there isn't, he excuses everyone but asks Sarah to remain behind. As we leave, I sneak a peek behind us. Sarah is sitting down where I previously sat, nervously watching everyone file out. Catching her eye, I smile at her and close the door. Chapter 35. Friday, January 9th. I grip the steering wheel nervously as I drive to Steve's house. He's throwing a party for everyone who has worked so hard on Phoenix and Unicorn, inviting people from both the business and IT. The roads are uncharacteristically icy, with no melting even after weeks of sunshine. It was treacherous enough that Paige and I decided to stay at home for New Year's Eve instead of celebrating with her family, as we usually do. It's been over a month since that last meeting with Steve and Sarah. We haven't seen much of Sarah since then. As I'm driving, I contemplate how quiet it's been. I keep expecting someone to call in another Sev1 incident. Instead, my phone just sits in the cup holder, completely silent, like yesterday, and the day before that. I can't say that I miss all of the excitement, but there are times now when I literally have nothing to do. Thankfully, I'm now coaching all my managers through our 2-week improvement cycles, according to the improvement kata, which keeps me from feeling totally useless. I'm especially proud that for an entire month, my group hit our target of spending 15% of our time on preventative infrastructure projects. And it shows. We're using the entire budget we've been allocated. We're closing our monitoring gaps. We've refactored or replaced our top 10 fragile artifacts so that they're more stable. And the flow of planned work is faster than ever. Against my expectations, everyone jumped enthusiastically on Project Narwhal, otherwise known as the Simian Army Chaos Monkey Project. Like the legendary stories of the original Apple Mac OS and Netflix cloud delivery infrastructure, we deployed code that routinely created large-scale faults, thus randomly killing processes or entire servers. Of course, the result was all hell breaking loose for an entire week as our test, and occasionally,
production infrastructure, crashed like a house of cards. But over the following weeks, as development and IT operations worked together to make our code and infrastructure more resilient to failures, we truly had IT services that were resilient, rugged, and durable. John loved this and started a new project called Evil Chaos Monkey. Instead of generating operational faults in production, it would constantly try to exploit security holes, fuzz our applications with storms of malformed packets, try to install backdoors, gain access to confidential data, and all sorts of other nefarious attacks. Of course, Wes tried to stop this. He insisted that we schedule penetration tests into predefined timeframes. However, I convinced him this is the fastest means to institutionalize Eric's third way. We need to create a culture that reinforces the value of taking risks and learning from failure, and the need for repetition and practice to create mastery. I don't want posters about quality and security. I want improvement of our daily work showing up where it needs to be, in our daily work. John's team developed tools that stress-tested every test and production environment with a continual barrage of attacks. And like when we first released the Chaos Monkey, immediately over half their time was spent fixing security holes and hardening the code. After several weeks, the developers were deservedly proud of their work, successfully fending off everything that John's team was able to throw at them. These are the thoughts going through my head as I wind my way toward Steve's house. The sprawling grounds are all covered by snow, hiding the immaculately manicured lawns. When I ring the doorbell an hour early, as Steve requested, I hear loud barking and then the sounds of a very large dog slipping on a hardwood floor, crashing into the door. "Come on in, Bill. It's great seeing you again," Steve says, holding the dog's collar and gesturing toward the kitchen with a skewer of vegetables in the other hand. When we get to the kitchen, he points to the counter in front of him, where a large metal bucket of ice sits, full of bottles. "You want anything to drink? Beer, soda, scotch?" Looking around, he adds, "Margarita?" I grab a beer out of the bucket, thank him, and then give him a quick summary of my somewhat boring day as he moves me to the living room. Steve smiles. "Thanks for coming over early. We're going to have a record-breaking quarter. We couldn't have done it without you and Chris. For the first time in years, our market share is up. You know, I wish I could see the looks on our competitors' faces. They're probably scrambling, trying to figure out how we did it." Steve is smiling broadly. "I actually saw Dick crack a smile the other day. Well, he showed his teeth at least. Project Unicorn and that new project, Narwhal, are helping us understand what our customers actually want. Our average order size just hit a record last week, and Dick said that Unicorn had the fastest payback of any project we've done in recent memory." He continues, "The analysts are starting to love us again. One told me last week that if we execute well, it'll be very difficult for our non-integrated competitors to follow us. No doubt, they'll be raising our stock price targets, and Bob is finally withdrawing his support to split up the company." "Really?" I say, raising my eyebrows in surprise. "I thought that Sarah was convinced that splitting up the company was the only way for us to survive." "Ah, yes," he says. "She's decided to look for other options elsewhere, and is on a leave of absence." My jaw drops. If I'm hearing this correctly, Sarah is being eased out of the company. I smile. "By the way," Steve says, "Project Narwhal, Project Unicorn, can't you guys come up with better names than that?" I laugh. No one is more upset about it than Maggie. She's convinced that all her product managers are laughing at her. She's told her husband that if the next project is called Hello Kitty, she'll quit. He laughs. "As you can guess, though, I didn't ask you to come early to critique your project names. Have a seat,"
As I settle into a cushy armchair, he starts to explain.
We've had an open position for the CIO for months. You've been a part of that interview process. What have you thought of the candidates?
Honestly, I was disappointed, I say slowly. They were all senior people with a lot more experience than me. They kept talking about tiny parts of the problem. They proposed only a fraction of what we've done in the past couple of months here at Parts Unlimited. I feel that if they signed on, we'd be at considerable risk of going back to all the bad old ways.
I agree with you, Bill, which is why I've decided that we should fill this position internally. You have any suggestions on who we should promote?
I go through the possible candidates in my mind. It's not a long list. I think Chris is the obvious choice. He was the driving force behind Unicorn, as well as Narwhal. If it weren't for his leadership, I'm pretty sure we'd still be stuck dead in the water. He smiles.
You know, it's funny. Everyone thought you'd say that. However, I won't be following your recommendations.
He continues.
This is going to take a while to explain. You were everyone's unanimous choice to become CIO. But to be brutally candid, I don't want you there.
Reacting to my obvious distress, he says,
Hey, relax. Let me explain. My board holds me responsible for making the best use of company resources to achieve the goals that maximize shareholder value. My primary job is to lead my management team to make that happen.
He stands up, walking over to the window, looking out at the snow-covered yard.
You've helped me see that IT is not merely a department. Instead, it's pervasive, like electricity. It's a skill, like being able to read or do math. Here at Parts Unlimited, we don't have a centralized reading or math department. We expect everyone we hire to have some mastery of it. Understanding what technology can and can't do has become a core competency that every part of this business must have. If any of my business managers are leading a team or a project without that skill, they will fail.
He continues.
I need each and every one of my business managers to take calculated risks without jeopardizing the entire enterprise. People everywhere in the business are using technology, so it's like the Wild West again, for better or for worse. Businesses that can't learn to compete in this new world will perish.
Turning back to me, he says,
In order for Parts Unlimited to survive, the business and IT can't make decisions exclusive of each other. I don't know where this is all going, but I know the way we're organized now, we're not firing on all cylinders.
I've been discussing this with my board for the past couple of months, he says, sitting down, staring right at me.
I know this expression. It's like my first meeting with him last year. This is what he looks like when he's trying to seduce someone.
I'm impressed with your performance and what you've done with IT. You use the same skills that I would expect anyone leading one of our large manufacturing divisions to use. Now, I want to see you grow and learn, and build new skills to best help all of Parts Unlimited. If you're up to it, I am prepared to invest in you. I want to put you on a fast-track, 2-year plan. You'll do rotations in sales and marketing, manage a plant, get international experience, manage the relationships of our most critical suppliers, and manage our supply chain. Trust me, this will not be a vacation. You're going to need help, a lot of it. Eric has kindly agreed to mentor you because we both believe this will be the most difficult thing you've ever done. But, he continues, if you achieve each of 15 specific performance targets we've laid out for you, we'll move you into a provisional chief operating officer role in 2 years, where you'll work closely with Dick while he gets ready to retire. If you work hard, get results, and play your cards right, you'll be the next COO of the company in 3 years.
I feel my jaw hanging open, my beer bottle dripping water onto my leg. "You don't have to answer now," he says, obviously satisfied that his pitch is having the desired effect. Half my board thinks I'm crazy. Maybe they're right. But I trust my instincts. I don't know how this is going to shape up, but I have confidence that this is what's best for the company. My gut tells me that in 10 years, when we're mopping the last pieces of our competition off the floor, this is the gamble that will have made that possible. "While we're dreaming big dreams here, let me say this," he continues. "In 10 years, I'm certain every COO worth their salt will have come from IT. Any COO who doesn't intimately understand the IT systems that actually run the business is just an empty suit, relying on someone else to do their job." Steve's vision takes my breath away. He's right. Everything my team has learned, as well as what Chris and John have learned, shows that when IT fails, the business fails. It stands to reason that if IT is organized so that it can win, the business wins too. And Steve wants to put me on the vanguard of this movement. Me, a technology operations guy. Suddenly I think of how one of Eric's higher-ups decided to Mustang him from a senior NCO to a lowly lieutenant, forcing him to climb the ladder again from the very bottom of the officer ranks. Obviously, Eric had the courage to do it, and the rewards for him, and his family, if he has one, seem pretty evident. He's living a life that seems to have transcended our mortal plane of existence. As if Steve knows what I'm thinking, he says, "You know, when Eric and I first met, many months ago, he said that the relationship between IT and the business is like a dysfunctional marriage. Both feel powerless and held hostage by the other. I've thought about this for months, and I finally figured something out. A dysfunctional marriage assumes that the business and IT are two separate entities. IT should either be embedded into business operations or into the business. Voila! There you go. No tension, no marriage, and maybe no IT department either." I just stare at Steve. In some Eric-like way, something about what he says seems inescapably true. In that moment, I decide. I'll still have to talk with Paige, but I know with certainty that the journey Steve wants to send me on is important, both for me and my family, and for my entire profession. "I'll think about it," I say solemnly. Steve smiles broadly and stands up. When I grasp his outstretched hand, he clasps my shoulder firmly. "Good. This is going to be fun." Just then, the doorbell rings, and within a few minutes, the whole gang is here. Wes, Patty, John, and Chris. So are Maggie, Brent, Anne, and, holy crap, even Dick and Ron. As the party starts to get louder and louder, each of them congratulate me, drinks in hand. It's obvious that they knew everything already, including Steve's startling offer to go on a 3-year training plan to become the next COO. Dick approaches me, holding a glass of scotch.
"Congratulations, Bill. I'm looking forward to working closely with you in the years to come."
Shortly, I find myself laughing with a bunch of other people, accepting their congratulations, and trading stories about the amazing journey we've been on. Wes claps me on the shoulder.
"Now that you're being promoted," he says, even more loudly and brashly than normal, "we all thought we should give you something that celebrates what we've accomplished. Something that you can take with you that will remind you not to forget about us. You know, little people."
As he reaches into the box at his feet, he says,
"We argued for a long time about what it should be, but in the end, it was obvious."
When I see what he pulls out from the box, I burst out laughing.
"Your old crap top," he exclaims, holding it high in the air. "It was a shame to make it unusable by bronzing it, but you've got to admit, it's beautiful, isn't it?"
In disbelief, I gape at it as everyone laughs, clapping and cheering.
It really is my old laptop. Taking it from Wes, I see the broken hinge and the duct tape I put on to hold the battery in. And now the entire laptop is covered in what looks like a thick layer of gold-colored paint, and it's mounted on a mahogany pedestal. At the bottom of the pedestal is a bronze label. I read aloud, "In fond memory of dearly departed Bill Palmer, VP of IT Operations," with the last year in parentheses. "Holy crap, guys," I say, genuinely touched by their gesture. "You make it sound like I died." Everyone laughs, including Steve. The evening goes by quickly, and I find myself surprised that I'm having such a good time. I'm not usually a social person, but tonight, I feel like I'm in the company of friends and colleagues who I respect, trust, and genuinely like. Sometime later, Eric arrives. He walks over to me, pausing to scrutinize the bronzed laptop. "You know, even though I give you a 50-50 chance of washing out, I still believe in you," he says, standing in front of me, taking a swig of beer. "Congratulations, kid. You deserve it." "Thanks," I say, smiling broadly, genuinely touched at his faint praise.
"Yeah, well, don't let me down," he says gruffly. "I've never liked this town, and you'll be making me fly into that godforsaken airport for years to come. If you screw this up, it will all be for nothing."
"I'll do my best," I say with a surprising amount of confidence. "Wait a second. I thought you'd be coming into town anyway for our board meetings."
"After what I've seen, I don't want any part of it," Eric says, laughing loudly. "I think Parts Unlimited is going to make a lot of money. We'll see how good your competition really is, but my suspicion is that they'll have no idea what hit them. For me, this isn't just idle theory. If all goes according to plan, within a couple of weeks, I'll likely be one of the largest investors in this company. The last thing I want is a bunch of insider information that restricts my ability to buy and sell."
I stare at Eric. He has enough money to become one of our largest investors, but still dresses like a manufacturing line worker. I never would have guessed that he cared so much about money. Eventually, I ask dumbly, "What do you mean by insider information?"
"I've long believed that to effectively manage IT is not only a critical competency, but a significant predictor of company performance," he explains. "One of these days, I'd like to create a hedge fund that invests in companies, taking long positions on companies with great IT organizations that help the business win, and short the companies where IT lets everyone down. I think we'd make a killing. What better way is there to force the next generation of CEOs to give a shit about IT?
He continues,
"I can't do that if I'm tied up as a board director in all these companies. Bad optics. Too much potential jeopardy with the SEC, auditors, and all that."
"Ah," I say.
"Hey, sorry to interrupt," John interjects, "but I wanted to congratulate you and pay my respects."
He then reaches out to shake Eric's hand, saying,
"And to you as well, sir."
Eric ignores his hand, staring at him up and down for a couple of moments. Then he laughs and shakes his extended hand.
"You've come a long way, John. Well done. And by the way, I like the new look. Very Euro discotheque."
"Thanks, Urkel," he says, deadpan. "I couldn't have done it without you. I'm grateful."
"My pleasure," Eric says jovially. "Just don't hang out with auditors too much. It's not good for anyone."
John shakes his head agreeably, returning to the party. Eric turns to me and says conspiratorially,
"Now that is a rather remarkable transformation, wouldn't you agree?"
I turn around to look at John. He's laughing and trading insults with Wes.
"So," Eric says, interrupting my train of thought, "what are your plans for the rest of the IT organization? Given this promotion, you've got some positions to fill."
I turn back to Eric. "You know, I could never have predicted this." Eric snorts dismissively, which I ignore.
Wes, Patty, and I have talked about this a lot. I'm sure I'm going to promote Patty to be VP of IT operations. She's the closest we have to a plant manager for IT operations, and she'll kick ass, I say with a smile.
Good choice, he responds. She certainly doesn't look like your typical IT operations manager, though.
And Wes?
Believe it or not, Wes made it very clear he doesn't want to be VP of IT operations, I respond. With less certainty, I say, if I'm supposed to vacate my role as CIO in 2 years, I think Wes will have a big decision to make. If I could wave a magic wand, he'd take over for Patty as head of IT operations, and Patty will become the next CIO. But how am I ever going to get everyone ready if Steve keeps heaping more responsibilities on me?
Eric rolls his eyes.
Give me a break. You're bored in your current role. You're going to become a lot less bored, fast. And remember that there are a lot of experienced people around you who've been on similar journeys. So don't be the idiot that fails because he didn't ask for help.
He turns to leave, but then looks at me with a glint in his eye.
Speaking of helping other people, I think you owe me something.
Of course, I respond sincerely, suddenly wondering if I've been set up from the very beginning.
Whatever you want, just say the word. I need you to help me elevate the state of the practice of how organizations manage technology. Let's face it, life in IT is pretty shitty when it's so misunderstood and mismanaged. It's become thankless and frustrating as people realize that they are powerless to change the outcome, like an endlessly repeating horror movie. If that's not damaging to our self-worth as human beings, I don't know what is. That's got to change, he says passionately. I want to improve the lives of 1 million IT workers in the next 5 years. As someone wise once told me, messiahs are good, but scripture is better. He says, I want you to write a book describing the 3 ways and how other people can replicate the transformation you've made here at Parts Unlimited. Call it the DevOps Cookbook and show how IT can regain the trust of the business and end decades of intertribal warfare. Can you do that for me?
Write a book? He can't be serious. I reply, I'm not a writer. I've never written a book before. In fact, I haven't written anything longer than an email in a decade. Unamused, he says sternly,
learn.
Shaking my head for a moment, I finally say, of course, it would be an honor and a privilege to write the DevOps cookbook for you while I embark on what will probably be the most challenging 3 years of my entire career.
Very good. It'll be a great book, he says, smiling.
Then he claps me again on the shoulder.
Go enjoy the evening. You deserve it.
Everywhere I look, I see people who are genuinely having fun and enjoying each other's company. With my drink in hand, I ponder how far we've come. During the Phoenix launch, I doubt anyone in this group could have imagined being part of a super tribe that was bigger than just dev or ops or security. There's a term that we're hearing more lately, something called DevOps. Maybe everyone attending this party is a form of DevOps, but I suspect it's something much more than that. It's product management, development, IT operations, and even information security all working together and supporting one another. Even Steve is a part of this super tribe. In that moment, I let myself feel how incredibly proud I am for everyone in this room. What we've pulled off is remarkable, and even though my future is probably less certain than any time in my career, I feel incredible excitement at the challenges the coming years are going to bring. As I take another sip of beer, something catches my eye. A bunch of my people start to look at their phones. Moments later, on the other side of the room, one of the developers next to Brent is peering into his phone, too, with everyone huddled around him. Old instincts kicking in, I urgently look around the room for Patty,
who is making a beeline toward me, her phone already in her hand.
"First off, congratulations, boss," she says, with a half-smile on her face. "You want the bad news or the good news first?"
Turning to her, I say with a sense of calm and inner peace, "What have we got, Patty?"
Afterward. The past. An homage to the goal. When Kevin Baer, George Spofford, and I first started writing The Phoenix Project, we never suspected how quickly DevOps would be embraced by technology professionals within all types of organizations. When this book was first published in January 2013, DevOps was very much in its early years, less than 4 years after the famous 10-plus deploys per day, Dev and Ops Cooperation at Flickr, was presented by John Allspaugh and Paul Hammond, and a little over 2 years after the first DevOps Days conference in the United States. However, virtually everyone in technology was already all too familiar with the problems commonly associated with waterfall software delivery processes and large, complex, Big Bang production deployments. This dissatisfaction with the status quo was driving increased adoption of not just DevOps, but also Agile and Lean. We knew from firsthand experience that these problems were being faced by almost every modern enterprise and across every industry vertical, regardless of the size of the organization or whether it was for profit or nonprofit. This nearly universal problem led to chronic underperformance throughout the entire technology value stream, which included development, operations, and information security. But worst of all, it led to chronic underperformance of the organization these technologists all served. With the Phoenix Project, we wanted to capture what the downward spiral looked and felt like, as well as what the surprising solutions felt like. So much about DevOps is counterintuitive, contrary to common practice, and even controversial. If production deployments are problematic, how on earth can deploying more frequently be a good idea? How can reducing the number of controls actually increase the security of our applications and environments? And can technology really learn anything from manufacturing? There are countless more examples of these difficult-to-believe claims. Because we wanted to show both the problems and solutions in a recognizable and relatable form, we decided very early on that the only way we could describe with adequate fidelity the enormous complexity of this problem was in the form of a novel, just like Dr. Eliyahu Goldratt did in The Goal, the seminal book he published in 1984. The Goal helped many of us have a giant and meaningful aha moment. It has been credited for helping make lean manufacturing principles become mainstream, and since its publication, The Goal has been integrated into almost every mainstream MBA curriculum and operations management course, influencing our next generation of leaders. When I first read The Goal around 2000, it was life-changing. Even though I had never worked in manufacturing, certainly never as a plant manager, there was no doubt that this book contained lessons that were relevant to the work that we do every day in technology. For over a decade, my co-authors and I wanted to write a version of The Goal for the technology value stream. This book obviously became The Phoenix Project, the book you're holding right now. Dr. Goldratt passed away in 2011, but left behind an incredible legacy. I'm particularly grateful for how he made time in 2004 to talk with Kevin Baer and me. It was amazing to see how he helped continually expand the theory of constraints body of knowledge. I would recommend to anyone who has interest in Dr. Goldratt's work to listen to his audiobook Beyond the Goal, which was released 21 years after The Goal. It brilliantly captures in one place his own lifetime of learnings and synthesizes those learnings into a comprehensible and comprehensive whole. In Beyond the Goal, Dr. Goldratt shares a story that was incredibly prescient for us. After The Goal was first published, Dr. Goldratt quickly started to receive letters in the mail about how people claimed that he must have been hiding in their manufacturing plants
because he described all the problems they were facing in their daily work, as well as how the theory of constraints enabled them to solve their problem. I can't think of a better or more persuasive testament to how well Dr. Goldratt understood the universality of the root cause of the problem, as well as the rules that described a generic direction for the solution. Without a doubt, we wrote the Phoenix Project as an homage to the goal, hoping to show that the same principles that Dr. Goldratt espoused originally for manufacturing could be used to improve technology work as well. As another nod to both the work of Dr. Goldratt and the way he released it, simultaneous to the publication of this new edition, we are releasing Beyond the Phoenix Project, an audio series collaboration between John Willis, co-author of the DevOps Handbook, and me. The project will cover both the figures and philosophies that serve as the foundation for the DevOps movement, including a whole module on Dr. Goldratt. I'm so pleased that the Phoenix Project is following in the footsteps of the goal. The Phoenix Project has sold 400,000 copies, and like the goal, it is being integrated into MIS programs, MBA curriculums, and even computer science programs. Sometimes the similarities to the goal are downright uncanny. Shortly after the publication of the Phoenix Project, we started receiving emails. Many espoused sentiments like the following. Holy cow! You're writing about our organization. It's like you've been hiding in our building. I know these characters. In fact, the application disaster in the book just happened to us. And incredibly, in one case, the application being deployed was even called Project Phoenix. It has been particularly gratifying to see how this book has been used across technology organizations, often in a book club format to discuss how the current system can pit development, operations, and information security against each other, making it virtually impossible to achieve the most important organizational objectives, and more importantly, how this led to completely new types of interactions to explore a better way of working, with much improved outcomes. I'm always amazed at stories where people have used the Phoenix Project to find each other. Often a change agent will recommend or give out copies of the Phoenix Project to scores of people, paying careful attention to who comes back saying, "Wow, what's happening to Parts Unlimited is happening to us, isn't it?" Sometimes seeing a copy of the book prominently on someone's desk or bookshelf serves as a signal that this person is a fellow traveler, one who sees a common problem that spans functional domains and is potentially a fellow conspirator, a fellow risk-taker, who is willing to work together to create a coalition to overcome powerful, entrenched incumbent systems. The Phoenix Project is ultimately a book about transformation. And so it is incredibly gratifying to see it being used as an instrument to create transformations in real life as well. Surprises on the journey. There are so many surprises and learnings on this journey, and I wanted to share a couple that seemed fitting for this afterward. One of the most delightful and startling blog posts I've read about the Phoenix Project was by Dave Lutz, famous for many things, including the server room-inspired cover song of Imagine by the Beatles that he performed at DevOps Days Mountain View 2011. In this post, he ponders the role of Brent, an all-too-familiar character in operations. He writes, "I find myself wondering what the outcome of the project would have been if Bill's first action was to fire Brent. Would the project have been finished earlier? I don't have a moral problem firing a fictitious character in a thought experiment. I wouldn't do this in real life, of course." Mr. Lutz writes about how there are two types of Brents, hoarders and sharers. He writes, "I've also come across otherwise smart people who are of the mistaken belief that if they hold on to a task, something only they know how to do, it'll ensure job security. These people are knowledge hoarders. This doesn't work. Everyone is replaceable, no matter how talented they are. Sure, it may take longer at first to find out how to do that special task, but it will happen without them."
For me, what Lutz wrote was fascinating for so many reasons, like how the Phoenix Project has become shorthand to describe certain categories of problems and a safe way to discuss and conduct thought experiments, not just on the effects of processes, but on people. And by the way, Mr. Lutz, I can state for the record that during the writing of this book, we always knew that Brent was a sharer, not a hoarder. In fact, Brent is the only character whose name we didn't change. And without doubt, as you speculated, our real-life Brent always had the best interests of the organization at heart and was merely a victim of the system. Another genuine surprise for me is how some people have written that we, the authors, must hate information security, and more specifically, that we hate information security people. One of the best examples actually came from a friend of mine, Paul Love, who was a co-author with me on Visible Ops Security. In a blog post, I published an email that he wrote me. When I first read The Phoenix Project, a novel about IT DevOps and helping your business win, John, the CISO character, made me angry. As a 20-year security veteran, John's total selfish my way or the highway attitude actually made me physically mad. Who did this guy think he was, anyway? Why was Gene painting the InfoSec practitioner in such an unflattering light? He continued, "After reading the book, I took a moment to look back on my career, thinking of all the people like John who I'd run into and worked with over the year. I realized, with a bit of terror, why I hated him so much. Before I studied Visible Ops and DevOps, I was John." I've sometimes received the same sort of reaction from people who don't know that I spent the majority of my career in the information security field as co-inventor of Tripwire, spending 13 years as the founder and CTO of a company focusing on automating security and compliance. As the saying goes, we tease who we love. In many ways, John, the CISO, is my favorite character, and in many ways, his journey most closely mirrors my own. As my friend Jez Humble, co-author of the DevOps Handbook, observed, John is a phoenix too. Well put, Jez. Whether we are a John, a Brent, a Wes, a Patty, or a Bill, when we're trapped in a system that prevents us from succeeding, our job becomes thankless, reinforces a feeling of powerlessness, and we feel like we are trapped in a system that preordains failure. And worse, the nature of technical debt that is not paid down ensures that the system gets worse over time, regardless of how hard we try. We know that DevOps principles and patterns are what allow us to turn this downward spiral into a virtuous spiral through a combination of cultural norms, architecture, and technical practices. As the Phoenix Project found its way into the world, another group of us were working on the DevOps Handbook: Jez Humble, John Willis, Patrick Dubois, and me. One of the amazing moments during the creation of this book was when our editor, Anna, asked us each to describe our DevOps aha moment. The amazing thing was that all of our answers were uncannily similar. We each described the incredible frustration of how difficult it was to do our work, whether it was the toil or the suffering. And we all shared the exhilaration of discovering the better way under this broad umbrella of practices we call DevOps. You can read about all of our aha moments in the first pages of the extended excerpt of the DevOps Handbook, included in the back of this 5th anniversary edition of the Phoenix Project. Looking into the future. The problems that DevOps solve are at the center of what every modern organization is facing. Now more than ever, technology is not just the nervous system of an organization. It actually composes the majority of the muscle mass. As Jeff Immelt, former CEO of GE, wrote, "Every industry and company that is not bringing software to the core of their business will be disrupted." Or as Jeffrey Snover, technical fellow at Microsoft, paraphrasing Dr. Nicholas Negroponte, wrote, "In previous economic eras, business created value by moving atoms. Now they create value by moving bits."
When the Phoenix Project was first published in 2013, DevOps was primarily used in internet companies, commonly known as FANGs, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Google. Of course, also in this category are Flickr, LinkedIn, Microsoft, Yahoo, Twitter, GitHub, and countless more. Now, 5 years later, it has been amazing to see these principles and practices in large, complex organizations across every industry vertical. This is incredibly exciting, because this is undoubtedly where the majority of the economic value of DevOps will be created. IDC, the analyst firm, says that there are about 11 million developers on the planet and 7 million operations people on the planet. At the time of this writing, it would be wildly optimistic to project that 1 million of these engineers are already using DevOps principles and practices. If that's the case, DevOps has 6.5% market share, leaving 93.5% of the market to go. The majority of these engineers are in large, complex organizations. These are the most well-known brands across every industry vertical, or supporting our largest government agencies or military services. The mission at hand is how we can elevate their productivity so that they're as productive as the high performers. We know through more than 4 years of State of DevOps reports conducted by Puppet that high performers are 2 to 3 orders of magnitude more productive than their peers. In my mind, helping everyone reach this level of high performance will create trillions of dollars of economic value per year, and is where the next surge of productivity will come from. In 2016, I was talking with my friend Rob England, often known as his moniker, the IT skeptic. We were fellow travelers in the ITIL space 10 years ago. We talked about how he famously and visibly changed his mind about DevOps. Initially, he believed, as many do, that anything that increases deployment frequency and enables developers more freedom inevitably leads to disaster. But through many interactions, he eventually realized that DevOps can lead to far better outcomes. If you want to explore his journey more, you can read my full interview with him on CA.com, Face-to-Face DevOps, to Protect and Serve. In our conversations together, we talked about how DevOps is inevitable, inexorable, and remorseless, and how DevOps is incredibly disruptive to the technology sector, to the technology field, and for anyone in technology. There's no doubt that DevOps is radically changing and transforming how we work in technology. Organizations that cannot adopt DevOps practices will be at a massive competitive disadvantage. As Dr. W. Edwards Deming is famously paraphrased, "Learning is not compulsory, neither is survival." Without a doubt, the best times for technology are ahead of us, not behind us. There's never been a better time to be in the technology field and to be a lifelong learner. On behalf of my co-authors, thanks to everyone who has made this journey so amazing and worthwhile. Gene Kim, Portland, Oregon, December 5th, 2017. The Three Ways, as excerpted from the DevOps Handbook: How to Create World-Class Agility, Reliability, and Security in Technology Organizations, by Gene Kim, Jez Humble, Patrick Dubois, and John Willis.